Chapter 7, The Ely Years. June is one of those wonderful wives who go with their husbands no matter where they go and no matter how unhappy they are doing it. So with June. She gave up the good life in Duluth, the friends she had, the clubs she belonged to, and all the rest. Along with myself and our four sons we had, she trooped to Ely, and for the first time entered the business world. Before, she had been a housewife at home, while my office was miles away downtown. Now she was an equal partner in a business she had to learn. This on top of raising four sons, ages 5 to 19. When I announced I was leaving the Arrowhead Network and was going to Ely to establish station WELY, my friends descended on me with remarks, the most mild being, "Are you crazy?" and "Are you out of your mind?" They reminded me that I was leaving a good job with years of seniority. I was. That I was a sick man. I was. That I was an engineer and knew nothing about business. Boy, were they right. I did not even know what a broadcast station rate card was. I had to go to my friend, Bob Kennedy, who owned KOZY in Grand Rapids, and ask him, "What is this thing called a rate card?" And their most crushing argument, there had been a radio station in Ely, and it could not make it, and had closed down. The market was too small for a radio station. But I was coming from the Morgan Murphy stable of fighters, and I could do all things, and feared no one. The station before was WXLT, who had operated a couple years but failed to win over the people and the business firms in Ely, and reluctantly closed the doors and left town. My WELY replaced them. 4 years before, I had picked my way along lonely, deserted, snow-covered roads in that cold New Year's Eve. That new station in Ely, WXLT, was about to come on the air, but first the FCC required certain electrical measurements to be made on the transmitting equipment and to be submitted to Washington for approval. Radio consulting engineers do this, and I was one of those. And because I was close by, I was asked to journey to Ely to do these things for the soon-to-go-on-the-air station. And, of course, it had to be done on New Year's Eve, because they were so anxious to start. And so June's husband rushed off to do the job, ruining another New Year's Eve. When a girl marries her handsome, brilliant electrical engineer husband, she somehow envisions that he would be at the radio station 9 to 5 and would always be by her side for all the important events in their married life, the birth of their children, birthdays, anniversaries, Christmas, New Year's Eve, and all the rest. Then, after the honeymoon wears off, she discovers she owns only a part of a man. The broadcast world owns the rest of him, maybe even the biggest part of him. So here I am, plodding along those deserted roads between Duluth and Ely on that cold New Year's Eve night. In Ely, I was met by a very excited young man, Charlie Ingersoll, who was heading the station to be. Through the night, hour after hour, I made the electrical measurements and adjustments, and then we were ready to put the station on the air for a test program. Of course, it was 3 a.m. then, but who noticed the darkness or the time? Charlie excitedly called his parents in McGregor, Minnesota, 110 miles away. Could they hear his station? No, they could not. The distance was too great for this WXLT signal to reach, and besides, the air was filled with other signals drowning WXLT out. Wearily, I went to bed in a room at the Forest Hotel there in town. It was now 5 a.m., and another New Year's Eve had been shot. Little did I dream, and how could I possibly know then, that 4 years later, I would be back in Ely, and then the abandoned WXLT would be mine. Same building, same tower, same transmitting equipment. How fortunate it is we cannot see ahead. Doing so would hopelessly confuse us, and we would not be able to function. Not being able to look ahead is one of the best things we have. That, and time, which is pretty good too. Time keeps everything from happening all at once. Now it is the summer of 1954, and I had said goodbye to my boss and to the Arrowhead Network, and I was in Ely to put my station, WELY, on the air. My son, Gary, now 19 years old, and I journeyed to Ely and set about building the station. We took over the old WXLT building, transmitter, and tower, but now the time had come to make changes, lots of them. The studio and offices had been located on the main floor. The basement was just an area with dirt floor and nothing else except a hot air furnace. I had a concrete floor poured in the basement, and that is where our studios were built. Upstairs, in the old studio office portion of the building, then became our home. June and the other three children remained in Duluth, selling our home there and packing up for the move to Ely. A delightful young couple, John and Marion Dickinson, purchased our home in Duluth in the end, with husband John first having a carpenter thoroughly inspect the house to make sure it was sound. It was. And Marion also insisted her father, a prominent Duluth attorney, come to the house to inspect it. He did, and it was just after cocktail time when he had paused a few minutes, and when he wandered around our home, he kept telling daughter Marion that this was the most wonderful house, and she certainly should buy it. Once he stood leaning against the kitchen stove, asking where the stove was located. Marion gently pointed this out, and in the end, I'm not sure Marion took her father's cheerful advice too seriously. So they moved in and were there for some years, until Marion contracted muscular dystrophy and I suppose is now gone. The last time June and I saw lovely, cheerful Marion was when we watched her being wheeled into the Pickwick dining room in a wheelchair in Duluth. June and I were dining there that night, and we saw her across the room. We cannot help but ponder the ways of our Lord. After the basement floor was poured, we looked around for a carpenter and found a real jewel. Calmer Jader, a thin, energetic Swede of 50 or 60 summers and winters. He walked in, looked over the lines we had drawn on the floor, showing where we wanted walls erected. Who needs blueprints when one can draw lines on floors and point here and there? This was all Halmer needed. He went over to the phone and yelled into it, "Give me the Vernuth Lumberyard!" This was long before dial phones in Ely, but the town did have telephone operators, and homes and places of business did have numbers. You picked up the phone and gave the operator the number, and she connected you. But not Homer. He did not bother with numbers. He just said, "Give me the Ace Hardware," or whatever place he wanted to reach. His commanding voice did the rest. Immediately after he had phoned in his first order for lumber, he began pacing the floor, saying, "What's taking them so long?" The lumber yard was 6 blocks away, but they did deliver the lumber in 20 or 30 minutes. Such is a small town. And Homer was a man of action. I remember hearing him say, "Here it is Monday, tomorrow's Tuesday, the next day is Wednesday, half a week gone by, and nothing done yet." I never did figure that one out, but who could figure Homer out anyway? And he did have a son, Harvey, a quiet, gentle man whom we came to love. He had a woodworking shop, which sadly burned down twice while we were there, a wood stove heating the shop, and with too many shavings piled too close and no one there. For no reason other than his affection for us, he built some furniture for us, a surprise which overwhelmed us. We have long since lost track of him, but a rumor came to us that his maker had called him back home, and that could be. It costs money to build a radio station, even a small station in a small town. We needed some. I went to the one bank in town and met the head of the bank, George Somero. I could use a loan, but the answer was a gentle no. The town had had a radio station, but that station had faded away. And who were we, and how long did we plan to stay there? Wearily, I went back to our studio, stationed 6 blocks up the hill, and told son Gary that we had a problem. But with the enthusiasm of youth, he knew we would find a way. We did. And it was the same George Somero who solved our problem. He came out to the station one afternoon and stood around watching son Gary and myself pouring insulation in the walls. He went upstairs and saw we were sleeping on a mattress on the floor, we having no furniture. He saw we were eating our meals out of cans, not having a refrigerator. He went back to his bank, and later I found out he said to the board of directors, "I've met these people. They are doing things right. I think we should lend them the money." And they did. Our hard work and penny pinching impressed him. A month before we went on the air, I went uptown to meet the merchants from whom we would need advertising revenue. But I did not talk advertising. Instead, all I talked to them about was asking the question, how could our radio station serve the community? They were surprised, but did come up with many answers. On the way out of the store, sometimes one of them would call out to me, "When are you going to sell advertising?" And I said, "I'd be back." It was along about then I met Father Mihelsik, that grand old man who is head of the one Catholic church in town. We got along famously. I so much respected the calm, gentle advice he gave me whenever I sought him out with a problem, which seemed to come often in those early years when I was new there. June and I were brought up in the Protestant church, but the father so impressed us with his philosophy, we just might have signed an application blank to his church had he handed me one those years. And I also got to meet the Protestant ministers right away, too. I wanted to provide each church in Ely the privilege of broadcasting over the station during their Sunday morning worship service. No charge, of course. So I met with the Protestant Ministerial Association one sunny morning, suggesting each church use the station for a month, rotating from church to church through the year. They liked that, but when we tried to decide which church got which month, the discussion became a little heated. Each church wanted the Christmas month and the Easter month. I tried to mediate this problem and then left the meeting suggesting they settle it and let me know. Somehow, they did. And every 6 months, I would get a letter telling me which church had which month. I never found out how they arrived at the months, but I imagine it was not easy. Father Mihelsik did not want to enter into this schedule plan, but I felt I should do something for his church, which, by the way, included half the people in that Catholic-dominated town. So I searched around and found I could get a 15-minute Sacred Heart daily program, which we aired every morning at 9:30 a.m. It was a Catholic church program with beautiful music and a beautiful lesson. Now all was equal, and I could turn to other matters. I had a sincere desire to fully enter into the life of the community and be part of it, and certainly not stand apart as a newcomer. So it came to me one day that a romantic way to do this would be to offer our operation as a broadcast house, seeing as how the station and our home would be in one building there on the edge of town. So we became known as Broadcast House, as much as WELY, and mail coming to us addressed to Broadcast House was thrown in the WELY box at the post office, along with mail addressed to Santa Claus at Christmas. This must have captured the hearts of Ely people and must have been part of the affection they felt for our family in the years that followed. We put the station on the air at 6 a.m. Saturday morning, October 2, 1954. Opening up with Russ Aviakainen, a veteran broadcaster who had come to us from a radio station in Upper Michigan because he wanted to be near his ailing mother living nearby. Russ was with us for several years and then left after his mother died. Also starting with us was a young man announcer just out of an announcer school in Minneapolis. He was a disaster, but happily Bob Basnick showed up to replace the unhappy young man, and Bob stayed with us years until he got into teaching work in Duluth. These two men carried the broadcast day, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., with our son Gary carrying on 6 p.m. to sign-off time, which was 10 p.m. That is Monday through Saturday. Russ and Bob stayed home on Sundays, and Sundays I was the announcer, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., with June bringing a meal downstairs to me at noon. Between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. Sundays, Gary would scrub and wax the station floors, and after he went to the university, I did this little chore. And when he was gone, evenings, we would hire local college men or women to run the station after 6 p.m. My day began at 4:30 a.m. when I would get up and go downstairs and type copy or the schedule and other little chores until 8 a.m., when I would go downtown and solicit advertising. We never did have a salesman. I did it all. We were successful. The station was in the black the first month and thereafter. But that first exciting morning, the morning the station went on the air with the entire town tuned in to find out what our new station was going to be like, included a very inebriated man who staggered in after we had been on the air 15 minutes. He apparently had just come from an all-night bar and was waving a dollar bill, insisting we play a request tune for which he was going to pay us. I told him we did not take money for request songs, but with the insistence of a drunk, he forced the money on us. the first dollar we earned in Ely, and which I still have today. We played his request. It was Indian Love Call, and he happily staggered out with that tune ringing in his ears. June was raising our four sons upstairs and doing endless office work downstairs. She would put a pan of food on the stove and dash downstairs and then forget the food, and there goes another pan. Once she was boiling eggs, and the pan ran dry, and the eggs exploded, splattering all over the ceiling. One day she tied the smallest one in a potty chair and forgot him. Coming back an hour and a half later, he was still sitting there, most unhappy. These were very busy, hectic months, but we were succeeding being an influence for good in the community. The people in Ely loved us. Endlessly they brought food, for what reason I don't know, except that they knew June was terribly busy. Again and again I was stopped on the street and was asked if we were doing all right financially. If we were not, there would be fund drives to help us. We did not need help. It seems when you are truly an influence for good in a community, your needs are somehow taken care of. The big chief in the sky seemingly has laid that rule down for all of us, although many people do not know about it. Then there was this wonderful sweet family, a father and mother and teenage daughter, who would come to our radio station every Saturday morning and put on their 15-minute religious program. He was the pastor of some tiny, obscure church at some crossroad out there somewhere. I imagine his church never had more than 15 or 20 parishioners, and he always insisted on paying $15 for airtime. We did not want to take it, but they were very proud and insisted we take their money, which often was in nickels and dimes and quarters, right from the collection plate, I suppose. Only at Christmas and again on Easter would they accept free airtime. But June and I found a way. At the end of the year, we would add up the money they had paid for program time that year, and we would then double it and make a contribution to their church. No church will refuse a contribution, and they did not, although they cried when we gave it to them. We left Ely, and I have no idea what happened to those wonderful, gentle people, but they've not really left us. In our home today sits the piano their teenage daughter used to sit at as she played accompaniment for her father and mother as they sang religious hymns before and after his sermon. We took that piano with us when we left Ely. It had been a gift to June from her father and her mother, so it really was a family thing. Today, when I walk by that piano, I can so vividly see that beautiful trio of God-loving people. I can almost reach out and touch them. Our Lord has sent some wonderful servants of His to be among us. Then there was the WELY Santa. I wanted a Santa to read children's letters to Santa at Christmas time, and on inquiring around, I found Minor Dan Toms was and had been the official Ely Santa for many years. I approached him, but he declined. He had been Santa for so many years, he was now tired of all those church Christmas parties, those lodge parties. Go find someone else. But in the end, he did come to the studio afternoons a couple weeks before Christmas and would read each child's letter. Many names he recognized. These children had mothers and fathers whose letters he had read to Christmas parties so many years before. But one thing was wrong. Dan had a high-pitched voice, and everyone knows Santa's voice is a low, ho-ho-ho sort of a voice. I was horrified at that first broadcast, and I went to him suggesting he lower his voice way down. On the next broadcast, he did, and he definitely was a regular Santa, and I was happy. And that is when the station phone began ringing. Who was that fake Santa? That was not the real Santa, the Santa the town had known since time began. I went back to him and told him to go back to being the real Ely Santa, and he was. And each year he would tell me he just could not be Santa again. But each year there he was in front of the WELY microphone, high-pitched voice and all. All letters to Santa were thrown in our box at the post office. Where those wonderful letters went in years past, I do not know, but now that we were there, we were Santa. A week after we went on the air, I came on Sunday afternoons at 4 o'clock with my Hello Neighbor program, in which I discussed things that had happened in the station through the week and things that had happened around town that week and in the past. It was sort of a poor man's Paul Harvey program and about 15 minutes long. That was in 1954. And now, many years later, I still had the same Sunday afternoon fireside chat, although in those years, there have been some gaps between radio stations. Many sponsors have wanted to be mentioned in my chats, but I have fought them all off. That program is just between you and me. And like I often say, here we are, loaf of bread, a jug of wine, and thou. And what are we going to do with all that bread? We were invited to all the social functions in town. To go to all of them, you would hardly have to cook at home. Some big functions, too, like the Protestant and the Catholic dinners. We did notice one thing. The Protestant dinners were always subdued and serious, and the Catholic dinners were always jolly, with lots of fun poking at the priest. Maybe that was just in Ely, but we did enjoy the Catholic dinners there. Of course, the Ely Catholics were mostly Slovenians, who naturally have song in their heart. Put three or four Slovenians together, and they immediately burst into song. The town was filled with music, and the incredibly beautiful music that pours out of the Catholic Church there was something to behold. Some scenes stick in one's mind, like that dark, rainy morning when I stood in a store on Sheridan Street and watched a funeral procession slowly go by. A black hearse with a mother's body inside. Beside the hearse walked four bareheaded sons, two on a side. It was raining, but they walked by, oblivious of the rain, walking beside their mother on her last trip to the grave. This was but one indication of the deep sentiment shared by all those wonderful Ely people. After we had been in Ely 1 year, my old boss, Morgan Murphy, drove to Ely to ask me to come back into his organization. I had to sadly say no, as I loved the man, but walking back into the old situation I just could not do. And it would have been harder, too. I was then 46 years old and no longer had the resiliency of my old self when half that age. He got June aside and asked her if she was happy there, and she lied like a trooper and said she was very happy, although she was not. The social life so important to her was not there, mostly because she did not have the time for anything outside the station. It was so unusual that he drove to Ely just to talk to me. I was impressed. The normal way of meeting my old boss was to receive a telephone call from his secretary the day before, with her saying, "Mr. Murphy will see you in his office tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. And you were in his office tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. Of course, I had much freer access to him and his office, but for most of the world, that was the way it was done. He went back home and from then on did not build any more radio or television stations. After that, he bought and sold properties, but the old days of establishing entirely new properties was over. Then came television cable. One morning, a member of the city council came to the station saying he had been appointed by the council to seek me out and ask if I could somehow bring television into Ely. The city was located behind a hill and could receive only very snowy pictures, if at all. The two TV stations in Duluth could not be received, and no other stations were anywhere around. I said I would look into it. Reading the Wall Street Journal, I was aware that there was such a thing as cable television in the mountains, in the east and the west, and possibly other places. I got in my car and drove to places in Wisconsin and in Michigan where I heard there was some crude cable systems operating. The towns were Rice Lake and Rhinelander, Wisconsin, and Houghton Hancock, Michigan. I came back to Ely knowing something about cable TV, but not much. One thing I had found out was that I would need a franchise from the city in order to string cables on city power poles up and down the streets in town. I went to the city council and told them this. They said they did not know anything about franchises and suggested I write one, which they would sign. I did. It was half a page long, the shortest franchise in the history of cable television. All it said was that I was welcome to hang my cables on city power poles. Today's franchises likely are 50 pages long and include everything six lawyers can think of, which is considerable. I proceeded to build a television cable system, starting with a four-tower array over across the golf course near the station, with a fifth tower across the gully also near the station. Son Gary and his friend erected those towers, greatly frightening me as they hung on swaying beams high above the ground. A local contractor came out and dug all the holes for the towers and guy anchors and refused to take a penny in payment for his services. I insisted on advertising his firm free of charge, and in the end he agreed to have me do this, but told me to tell people in the ad they should not call him as he had all the business he could handle. Just don't ask them to do their job. The towers went up and cables were run to the station nearby. Excellent pictures were received from the two TV channels in Duluth, channels 3 and 6. Now the time had come to run the cable downtown to customers, but also now I was out of money. So a trip down to George Somero's bank asking for a loan. I was turned down, gently of course, but with a definite turn down. George could understand radio, but television cables were so new he just could not visualize how they worked, so it was a no. I went back to the station and found I had just enough cable to run down the street to George's home. Happily, he lived on that side of town. That afternoon, I ran the cable to his house and to his TV set in the living room, and then left. The next morning, George was on the phone, all excited about the TV pictures he had watched the evening before. So vivid, he said, he could see the sweat on the boxer's face, and suggested the next time I was downtown would I come in and see him about that loan. It just so happened I was in town 5 minutes later, and I sat down at his desk, and there was a loan. Now I began running cable up and down city streets, but a lot more money was needed and beyond the legal lending ability of George's bank. So I turned to my good friend, Carl Johnson, who owned and ran Northwest Radio Company in Duluth. And he let me take cable from his store with sometimes amounts up to $10,000, all of which was shortly paid back, of course. But I was picking up money from my cable customers too, of course. We charged $125 for connecting a home, of which they paid $50 now and signed a note for the remaining $75 to be paid off at $25 a year for the following 3 years. I took these notes to George's bank as collateral on our loan. The cable slowly spread through town, taking a year to get to the other side. In the end, we had 1,100 customers, each paying $3.50 per month for the service and still owing me $55,000. But I could not find a technician to service the miles of cable and all the amplifiers on poles all over town. So I was the serviceman, the only one we had the years we were there. With 1,100 customers, there were bound to be trouble calls. But mostly it was June who took these trouble calls over the phone. A call would come in from a very irate lady customer telling June the cable had been out for a week and they weren't going to pay for service they did not get. June would immediately side with them, telling them she wouldn't pay for service that they didn't get either, and June would also suggest they tear out that month's coupon from the book and just not pay it. About that time, the angry lady would begin to hedge a bit, saying, well, maybe it was not a couple weeks, but a shorter time. The truth likely was a tube had just burned out in their set, and the set was still warm when the lady called us at the radio station. And the customers did pay with coupons. The printer would deliver to us sets of 24 coupons on which we would print the customer's name and address, and we would staple these coupons into a folder and mail to the customer. This we did on our kitchen table evenings to all 1,100 customers. The customer would then take the coupon to the bank downtown and make payment there. Now that we had a cable system along with a radio station, I had even more work to do. It was still up at 4:30 a.m. and after 8 a.m. calling on radio station customers, as well as shooting trouble calls on the cable system. That is Monday through Saturday, and of course Sundays I ran the station alone all day. In the 5 years we were there, we did not take one day off. But everyone should notice we were successful. Very successful. The young people today think there is some magic way to become successful. There isn't. It's just plain hard work. Paul Harvey has said, lots of people want to arrive at a successful destination without making the trip. Well, we made the trip. There were problems, several a day. So wearily, I would strap a ladder on top of my car and drive to the trouble spot. The mini amplifiers were in metal boxes high up on poles, so I had to climb a ladder at each trouble spot. In the wintertime, with temperatures around zero and the wind blowing, it was with numb fingers I adjusted the controls on the amplifiers. Many of the trouble calls were in homes. The pictures had gone off. With a small portable receiver, I showed them the signal was still on the cable, so it must be their set. I got into a lot of homes those days. One home I went into revealed a TV tube so old it would only show a dim picture. Why should they pay for cable service when the pictures were so dim? A month later, I was back at that home again, only now the picture tube had faded down to where there was no picture, only sound. Their complaint now was that the cable sound was weak. I don't remember what happened in that home, but they did indeed have a TV set problem. One joker made some adjustments inside his TV receiver, making the pictures upside down on the screen. He then called me complaining that we were sending out upside down pictures, and we had better stop that. What he was really after was to have me talk about his set on Sunday afternoon's Hello Neighbor talk show. He got his wish, and no more upside-down pictures showed up around town. I wired up a slide projector operating system on Channel 4. With drawing pen, I would sketch weather forecasts and other news items, changing the wording several times a day. On election nights, I would hurriedly sketch in the latest returns and quickly get them on Channel 4. Then I would sit down at the WELY mic and read the same returns, complaining that the cable Channel 4 had beat WELY with returns, darn it. I dreamed of the time when I could replace the slide projector with a TV camera, but the astronomical cost of TV cameras at that time made that impossible. Today, one can buy a beautiful TV camera at any TV supply store and at a very low cost, and in color, too. One day, a man came from Duluth and visited his Ely friend and commented on the clarity of the TV pictures. He asked his Ely friend what kind of antenna did he have. The Ely friend took the Duluth man outside the house and pointed at our receiving towers almost half a mile away, way across town. The Duluth man, a bit awestricken, said, "You sure have a long lead-in," and I guess it was a bit long at that. Time went by, and then the two iron ore mines in Ely closed, and the town panicked. As far back as anyone there could remember, those mines had operated providing jobs for fathers followed by sons. There was no other industry in town. The mines had always been the only industry, and now that was gone. It was with shock that June and I looked over the situation. We realized that there were 1,100 cable customers of ours who still owed $50 on that cable connection note they had signed with us. Now, everyone was out of work, and no one knew where the next meal was coming from. So June and I prayed over this, and in the end, wrote each of these customers a letter, telling them we were tearing up that note and they owed us nothing. Then the telephone calls, the letters, and cards came in, thanking us for doing this. We felt we didn't need the money, and it was the Christian thing to do. I was sitting, mulling over this one day, and suddenly it dawned on me that what I had done was illegal. I had destroyed the collateral held by the bank against their loan to me. I hurried to George Somero at the bank and humbly confessed to my terrible mistake, but George just laughed and tore up the collateral notes and told me to forget it. I don't know if I could have been sent to jail for this offense, but destroying collateral is something the law does take a dim view of, but I did squeak by that one. I guess one can be a Christian and a criminal at the same time, but one never plans it that way. But the economic sands of time were running down in Ely, in fact, all across the Iron Range, and it was time for us to go. We did not want to be a part of a dying community. I was now 50 years old, and I felt I should put some roots down in a more permanent lifestyle. We called in a radio station broker, and he found an investment group in Sioux City, Iowa, who purchased the station and the cable company and sent their own man to Ely to run both. I went around town saying my goodbyes and found it so difficult. I soon gave up without saying goodbye to a great many wonderful people I should have seen. One place I went was to the office of the city clerk, where Art Knutson held forth. I started to tell him we were leaving and why, and after a few sentences the word just would not come out as Art stared at me. I got up and left in the middle of a sentence, and it was pretty much the same way wherever I went to say goodbye. I could give no reason except I had lost faith in the community and wanted to be away. Try that on people you love. As we drove out of town that afternoon, never to return, we made one last stop, and that was to say goodbye to that kindly, loving priest, Father Mihelsik. We talked a bit, and he gave each of our sons $1 to spend at Disneyland in Los Angeles, as we told him we were going there. Then we cried a bit, and he put his hands on our heads and blessed us. I can still feel his hands on my head, although many years have now gone by, and he had since gone to be with his big boss in the sky. So ended the Ely years. When we came to Ely, they had no radio and no television. When we left, they had both.